Hi, I'm Jim O'Shaughnessy. I was Howard's original guest on Panic with Friends. And I'm panicked about nothing.
Howard.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you, too. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks for asking.
You look as young as you were the last time I saw you, even though you've had a birthday in between.
Yes, I'm 57. We are changing the format. I took 2 months off. You only thought I was taking 1 month off. So I apologize. Let me just apologize to you publicly. I mean, you didn't tell me because you're so polite that we had planned to come back in August 2022. I've had a midlife crisis. I would say a three-quarter life crisis because I'm definitely closer to death at this age. But I just buggered off for an extra 6 weeks, not knowing that you decided you would change your summer plans to come home.
Hey, so, no big deal.
Let me apologize. The good news is it was cold here this summer. It was only 150 from 120.
Yep, you're right.
And so I apologize for that.
No worries, man.
But I think it's important to know that I had a fabulous time, which is really all that matters.
Of course.
So you have been to Ireland, yes?
Very briefly.
Yes. And I just got back. I had spent a summer with the fam in Coronado, and I decided with some friends, two guy trips. The first guy trip was a cycling trip canoe, and it was spectacular. Have you been to Lake Como?
Yes, I have. Beautiful.
Okay, so I had been for a meal taken in the lake, you know, on the way to somewhere else. You know, Italy, everywhere you go is fantastic, but I spent, I think, 6 days at this time climbing up in the mountains and over the mountains and back the other side in Bormio, and I had never done it, you know, where the euro was this cheap, or the dollar was this strong, or at this time of the year, or with just friends. So it was different. It wasn't like for romance or anything. It was just pure guy, goofball, a lot of food, a lot of hiking, a lot of climbing on a bike, and a lot of nonsense. I've never been to a place that spectacular. Only an hour from Milan. I hadn't put all the pieces together. And I know there's a point to this, but I've already gone off track. But anyways, Italy and the biking was phenomenal.
I can imagine.
And so I was with five guys. And I don't know if we do the math here. So we've done four trips together as guys with this guide, Filippo. And we were sitting down one day, and we all know, you talk about our wives all the time. And it turns out that the five of us combined, we're still married to our first wives, 138 years of marriage, which may, I don't think you could randomly, and Jim will know this because Jim's our guest. I don't think you could put randomly five people. You could run that simulation 1,000 times, put five guys in a room in Como and get 138 years of marriage on their first wives. Still married.
That's amazing.
Yeah. So I think that's why Ellen lets me go. She goes, what kind of trouble could 138 years of marriage get into? Let me just tell you, not much. No, really not much, Canoon, sadly. We had some Merlot and some beer. And really, it was just a phenomenal group of guys. Great trip. Then I headed over to Tel Aviv and then over to Ireland. We'll talk a little bit about Jim with that. I do know why people leave Ireland. I don't know why people stay. So we will probe that. You know, it's now October 2022, which is something you don't like doing, but I think the new format, I am just going to timestamp everything and talk about what's going on in the world. And it has been a fascinating summer away, seeing from Europe the headlines there about the war, following the U.S. dollar, following the markets. From afar, being over in Israel and seeing the tech scene, you know, getting a hint of what's going on in the rest of the world while the markets are in turmoil here. And then I return, and it's just been a fascinating moment in the markets with interest rates, you know, shooting up. So in the spirit of why we started Panic with Friends in March 2020, when you and I sat down and did this, I said, you know what? You know, get me back into the groove. Let's have a friend of mine on. In the spirit of Friends, in the spirit of Panic, we're not quite in the March 2020 panic, but it's been a brutal month, a brutal year. It's been taxing. I can feel it in the, this isn't like March 2020 when it was a different type of fear. This is just kind of a pounding headache that is grinding people. COVID, my in-laws have it right now. A lot of my friends have COVID. It's definitely, call it what you want, but it's still here. Are you seeing cases? Are you hearing about it?
Yeah, there's a few.
Seen more in my, again, it's COVID. It's not like people aren't dying, but at least in my group, but everybody has it right now in my group. So 2 years later, 2.5 years later, COVID's still a thing. The VIX is now 30-ish. It was in the 70s when we started this podcast.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
So that's different. And whereas interest rates were on their way to zero and negative in 2020, they're at, you can buy a 1 year T-bill at 4%. Robinhood is offering 3% interest insured up to $1 million. So from a moment when you were depositing cash and earning zero, you can earn real money not doing anything right now. And we have inflation. And we have Feds still raising rates. So this is a completely different era, a completely different moment in time for a Panic with Friends. So who better to bring on than Jim O'Shaughnessy? We're going to get Jim on the phone, but let's just say I loved his intro where he is not panicked about anything, which is why he was our first guest. That show time-stamped in March 2020 was a perfect time to enter the markets. I want to check in with Jim to see how he feels his spider tingly senses around markets right now. He's more of a systems and quant, so he doesn't time the markets, but I just want to get his calm assessment of what the world looks like. I won't say his age, but he's older than me, is he not?
I don't know.
All right, we'll ask him. So let's get Jim on the phone.
Sounds good.
Jim!
I've been waiting. You don't call, you don't write.
Well,
you go,
unfortunately,
and you send all these great pictures, and you don't invite me. I'm kind of incensed, actually. You went to both one of my favorite places in the world, Lake Como.
Oh, yeah.
Where I go every year, and except during the pandemic, and then you go to my bloody homeland without even giving me the heads up on that. What the fuck is up with you, Howard?
Well, let me just tell you, first of all, you have incredible taste because I sent a picture from this place, not to name drop, but it is not a widely listened, shamed podcast. Pasa de Agua, I think is the name. And I had never seen.
Pasalacqua.
Pasalacqua.
The Villa Pasalacqua.
Yeah. Okay. So I had not seen this type of setting in my life. I've been around the world. I've seen nice places. I've stayed in nice places. I know friends with nice places. I love Italy. I had a sense that there were places like this in the world. I've seen James Bond movies. Nothing prepared me for what I saw at this place. And then I shared a picture thinking, ha, 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 ha. And you said, well, you stayed there. So tell me how you found a place like this. It was a pre-internet, or because now it was an American-owned place, this Pasa Agua. And now it is a hotel. How would you find out about something like how does this type of place exist in the world?
So, really interesting story. We normally stay at a hotel that is nearby the Villa Pasa Agua, on Lake Como. And so we, when we're there every year, we always take a boat out at least once or twice and go to some of the other towns because they're beautiful too,
beautiful.
Like Bellagio and whatnot. And so we were heading towards Bellagio, which is a town up the lake. And I looked and saw the Villa Pasa Agua. And I'm like, good Lord, that place is gorgeous. And so, you know, I think I jotted it down in one of my journals. And I was meeting with my book agent, of all things, And I'm telling him, he's like, this is in 2005, okay? So he says, you know, how was your time in Italy? And I'm like, great, you know, stayed at the normal place, saw this incredible place. And we looked it up and they call it the Villa Passalacqua. And he starts laughing. And I went, what? He goes, that is a really good friend of mine that owns that. And I'm like, really? And I go, ex-Mormon like you. And he goes, oh yeah. And so I would love to meet him. And he goes,
he's an American.
He's an American. Yep, he's an American. His wife is wonderful and charming, and he's got beautiful daughters and very nice guy. Anyway, so we got invited over the next time we were at in Como and really hit it off. And like, I asked him, like, so why are you an ex-Mormon? And he holds up his whiskey glass and he says, whiskey. I'm like, that's a good reason, man. That's a good reason.
That is a great reason.
And so anyway, we were looking for a special place to celebrate our 25th wedding anniversary. And so I'd become reasonably good friends with this guy. And so I emailed him and I'm like, do you ever like rent the villa out? And he's like, yeah, sure. We'll rent it out to you. And I'm like, that is awesome. So it was set up differently as the hotel. The hotel knew about me and they sent me all the pictures ahead of time and wanted me to say nice things about it, which I did because I think they did a beautiful job.
Beautiful.
Anyway, so it was set up very differently when it was a private home.
Mm-hmm.
But the number, well, you've been there, so you know, Howard.
I think there's 14 rooms, but it's huge.
Right. Yeah, it's huge. And so anyway, I invited my entire family and they all came.
Yeah.
And it was literally the last time my father, who died in 2017, so 10 years later at the age of 97, it was the last time he like went on a normal trip to Europe. And he had a blast and we had like all of his grandchildren, his great grandchildren were all there. And we just had the best time in the world. And, you know, because my agent knew the owner and then I became friends with the owner. So that's how I know about it.
Social leverage at work. The lesson to me is when I go to Europe, block you so you can't one-up me on all my travails. So thinking that I could not top this, James, and I go with this group of guys, 130, we've started a firm, 138 Ventures, because we've been to combine married 138 years. I guess we'll change the name next year, hopefully to 143. I could not think that could be topped. Now, Passalacqua is more historical. So across, a two-minute boat ride across the lake is a hotel called Il Serena, not pronouncing it right. And it's in a James Bond movie, didn't know that. And it was a modern place that blew my mind. So Lake Como, congrats to you for going there this long. I now will make that a yearly place with the missus. And anyways, I cannot believe in a modern world we get to go to places like this. And the joy of like discovering these places and just the sheer scale of the steepness of Como and the water and the calm, it blew my mind.
Como is my happy place, man.
Yeah.
It is, if you are... And I'm lucky that I don't get stressed out very often, mm-hmm. but like if you are stressed out and you go to, and by the way, another location in Como was used in the first Bond reboot, Casino Royale, when after he was recovering, if you remember, and the Swiss guy came to give him the money.
Knut's nodding,
the poker
yes.
Game. Yep. Yeah. So that is also on Como.
Yeah.
That structure.
I have to say that I'm late to the game. Clooney and co have discovered this place, but it's never too late to enjoy Italy. And seeing the Dolomites last year, I said, wow, I don't know why I've been wasting my time in Tuscany all this time. And now I'm like, I don't know why I'm wasting all my time in the Dolomites in Tuscany with Como. And I have to say that the Milan... has potential also now to be an emergent boom town with culture and fashion and technology. Italy is well placed. I mean, economically and now the government-wise, what a mess. Most of Europe. So a lot to learn from spending time in Europe. While I was there, where the Italy, as you said, you go to Calm and the VIX, I say the VIX is always four in Italy. The VIX here, in a segue to the stuff that people want to hear us talk about. Not that we like talking about what other people want us to talk about, but let's talk about the fact that the world has changed.
Yeah.
And it has changed from a global macro. You and I are the same people. We love our kids. We're engaged in our kids' lives mainly. We kind of look at the world the same way, slanted eye, cynical, but optimistic. You are a mentor to me just because of age, not because of success. So, Canute, you're listening. The Canute just put your number up, and I'm like, holy shit, that's a big number. But I aspire, the first week of Panic with Friends, it was you, Fred Wilson, and a lot of my friends that are more mentory, and not just from a business perspective, how you look at the world, how you share, how you live with your family, and how you take risk. And how you like to share a mentor. So here we are. The world, it's a different type of panic than 2020. And I know in 2020, there definitely, we all were a little bit like shaken. And here, I don't feel panicked now, because I've been through a few. We're not locked in our homes. I just spent a glorious, summer away. But it does feel different to me. And while I'm not panicked, I sense that the world has changed. How do you feel about where we are in a macro sense, like interest rate, risk, portfolio structure? What are you seeing?
So, first I would preface it by saying you have to ask me whether you're asking strategically or tactically, right? The two are very different. So strategically, I'm going to give the same advice that I gave on the first Panic with Friends, which is don't panic.
It's too late to panic.
Yeah, stocks are on sale. If you're young, this is the best time in the world for you to be accumulating risk assets, right? Mm-hmm. And so strategically, that's still my advice, right? If you're 40 and you want to retire at the traditional age of 65, you got 25 years left. And what you need to remind yourself of, I was just down in my lower level and I had this collection of old newspapers that I kept, right? So one of the ones that I was just looking at was the crash of 1987, which I, being 5 years older than you, people can do the math.
5 years US or Canadian? There's a difference.
5 years.
What
5
month?
Years US.
All right, five and a bit.
Yeah, May, yeah. And plus, come on.
5 years,
who pegs anything
months.
To the other than Canadians, Howard, who pegs anything to the loony? I mean, really, come on, let's get serious.
Good point.
But so I'm looking at the headlines, the crash, the biggest crash ever on a single day, bigger than the 1929 crash that ushered in the Great Depression.
Percentage-wise,
and when you when you read the news of the time, I'm looking at the journal the day after, right, mm-hmm. downstairs, mm-hmm. And what you see is a couple of things. First off, we think we are cursed with this idea that we know what's going to happen in the future. We have no idea what's going to happen in the future. We can directionally say, I think that these big macro trends will continue, right? And you're usually pretty safe with that. As long as the United States has the Bill of Rights and the rule of law, guess what? The most inventive and creative people are going to want to live here and work here because that's the magic sauce that allows you to succeed. As long as those kind of guardrails are in place and the wackos aren't allowed. Well, we had somebody who was pretty wacky and the system just swallowed them up, right? And it's kind of okay.
It's a good way to look at it because there's both sides, left and right.
Yeah.
The system took care of it.
Exactly. And that's the way to think about it strategically. Our system is brilliant in the United States, and it was built by people who were what I call rational optimists. In other words, they were very optimistic about the future, but they knew what men and women were like. Back then, it was just men. Luckily, now it's both men and women.
How did we get so lucky that they were rational optimists? I guess that's just, we were lucky.
You know, that we were lucky, and that was the age of enlightenment and the age of reason. And we lucked into it, man, because if we had been founded, like, say, when India was founded, for example, socialism was in the ascendancy India was founded. And so it affected, like, the zeitgeist and the vibe affects everything. And so, like, if India had been founded and Gandhi, but that was 200 years earlier, they'd probably be the richest, most prosperous country in the world. Because they would have had the Bill of Rights, they would have had the rule of law, all of the things that the Age of Reason gave us kind of just by luck, right? But back to strategically, like, so if you're just thinking about that retirement of yours, which is 25, even 5 years in the future, quite frankly, because I brought up the journal and the crash for a reason. We all think that whatever we are going through is unique. Right. And oh, it's never been this bad. If you even glance at history, it's been so much worse in the past. And we made it through just fine. And like, try to tell somebody who's like my son's age, 37. Right. Try to explain to them viscerally what the crash of 87 felt like. And they shrugged their shoulders. Right. Because I would, too. It's a blip. So directionally, nothing has changed from my point of view, right? Now, you asked macro, and so now I'm going to give you the tactical side, right? Mm-hmm. So, of course, this had to happen. Ultimately, the reason economics actually makes sense in the end is that, like, you can't have magic money that grows on trees. It's got to be tied to value in some way, in some way, shape, or form. And when you put the cost of capital to zero, what happens? People go crazy and they're willing to invest in anything because actually that's the rational thing to do. Your hurdle rate is zero, okay? Mm-hmm. Hurdle rates are almost never zero. And what traditionally you've looked at as your cost of an opportunity was whatever the risk-free treasury rate was, right? And so a whole generation of investors has grown up knowing only a zero cost of capital rate. Mm-hmm. And so they, because of another bias that we, you know, domesticated primates have, is, you know, everything we have.
I don't want to be put in a bucket, Jim.
Yeah. Knowing you, I would be willing to upgrade you to domesticated primate.
Well, thank you,
from
sir.
Where you are now. Ellen has that effect. She is the one who domesticates you. But from the point of view of another one of our biases, and you know, which is why I always say the last sustainable edge is to arbitrage human nature, because it doesn't change.
Correct.
We never learn. And so we have a recency bias, which is endemic now, right? So the recency bias is we vastly overweight what's happening now. We vastly underweight what has happened in the past. And we do what's called hyperbolic discounting. So like literally, if you're only thinking about like, what is the market going to do tomorrow? What you don't know, if you haven't studied like the way our brains work, is you have effectively said to your brain, tomorrow is the last day of my life. And you are going to make really bad decisions when you do that. However, you can transcend the recency bias and get a better perspective by understanding the history of money, the history of interest rates, the history of stock markets, you're going to see, look, man, they call it the equity risk premium for a reason. Why do people get this magic higher return from equities? Oh, it's magic. No, it's not. You're being compensated for taking much greater risks. But as you elongate that, right, so what looks the most risky in the short term, like right now, stocks, right, they and other risk assets, they look really risky in the short term. What looks super safe in the short term? T-bills, always, right? If you elongate your attitude, right, and you say, well, let's look at all rolling 20-year periods, okay? I did that in a book called Predicting the Markets of Tomorrow. Guess what happens? They flip-flop. Mm-hmm. What appeared as the riskiest asset in the short term is actually the least risky in the long term in terms of your returns. Mm-hmm. And what looks safe in the short term is a disaster in the long term. When you look at T-bills, for example, the ultimate safety, right? Backed by full faith and credit of the U.S. government, we're still, despite what everyone says, the unipower. And like we get to repay our debt in our own currency. We have so many advantages.
Oh my God, it's so tilted.
Right?
That's why I say go to Italy. You'll see how bad life is.
Exactly. Yeah. But see, the point is you go back to 1927 where there's good data too. And you go forward to the last time I did it was 2009. But I talked to some of my guys earlier this week and it's the same now. Basically, what's your return on investing in U.S. treasuries after inflation? Nothing.
Really?
So if you went back in time and said, grandfather, I want you to invest just in stocks, he would look at you like you were insane, mm-hmm. right? Because we probably would have hit him in the 30s during the Great Depression. Mm-hmm. And he would have thought you were just nuts, right? And he would look at you and say, no, safety of Uncle Sam, man. But when you look at the returns to equities versus T-bills, stripping inflation out, equities just are like 10x better than T-bills. But T-bills, literally your return $1 goes to $1.50 over almost 100 years.
Now that's counting the depreciation in the dollar?
Yes.
Or no.
Yes.
That's just,
It is. No, it is. It's inflation adjusted. The real return.
Yeah. It's really interesting there. I would add, so you said two things. Transcending recency bias, because I've been telling people the problem that we'll have going forward here, and this is the opportunity really, is that everybody's going to have recency bias. And this is just going to mess with young people's minds because that's what the markets do. It's the ultimate, cork and confetti on this bear market is that it leaves a recency bias. That's why I don't think we're done yet. But I think at the same time, this was a great time to have this discussion with you because I have truly not enjoyed the last 2 years. It's been funny. You and I had a lot of laughs.
Yeah,
watching Dave Portnoy. We knew how to compartmentalize watching Dave Portnoy and what he did. I thought it was genius for about a month.
Oh, it really was. It was marketing genius. Still willing to say that. It was marketing.
Yeah,
coup.
I'm still willing to say it. I'm a little more disappointed in how he ran with it. But I mean the sheer genius of the folly of it was he was just taking a piss on everybody.
Sure.
Do you think he bought his own? Like, we don't know him. I don't know if you know him. I feel like he bought into that. I think the market got him too. Or what do you think happened?
Yeah.
There?
So I don't know him.
If you were to speculate, period, how do you think that ended?
Poorly.
Yeah, that's what I think. Like, I mean, I think he started to believe it.
Yeah. And so the problem that I have with it is I thought it was incredibly entertaining.
Yeah, you and I poked that.
And I thought that it was a genius marketing stroke because what he gained or lost, usually lost, right? Yeah. You couldn't buy that kind of coverage for 10x, 20x, 30x what he lost.
Yeah.
So like genius there. The thing that like if I had a bone to pick, it was like, oh man, it's the same with like Robinhood and a lot of the trading apps that are like games.
Yeah.
Like I really support things that get young people to take investing seriously.
Correct. So we both were calling each other going, I wish I had thought of this.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so like, it's like young people are time billionaires.
And I like that.
And they should definitely be able to use that, right? Exchange the time for risk. They should be like risk, the most risk-seeking group there
I'm
is.
I'm a time hundreder at this point. Hence
well,
T-Bill.
Because I'm going to, yeah, well, there you go.
Okay, so time bill, yeah. So we both thought he was smart enough, but so keep going.
Yeah, but then what happened is they got the wrong message, right? And they got the message that like, oh, investing is fun. Oh, you know what? This is great. Like the whole meme stock thing. It's like, you know, the real story there, which no one will ever believe, and that's fine. We love our stories. And so the story that everyone bought into was this David and Goliath, right? That the little guy really poked the big guy in the eye. Yeah, right?
Yeah.
That is not what happened. I really hate to be the one to, you know, put the turd in the punch bowl here. But if you don't understand that that was a battle of hedge fund titans, and if you don't understand that both of those hedge funds had their own analysts in Wall Street Bets on Reddit painting the tape to lead the other non-sophisticated people on those chat boards into these trades, well, then I got a bridge right here in good old New York to sell to you.
I know, right? Like, you and I were like, I cannot believe who they made the scapegoat. And I got to go down this rabbit hole with you. So where do you think Dave got, do you think he got bad advice, or do you just think he lost himself in the emotion, in the human behavior of it?
Yeah, so I definitely, look, I don't know him, so I
I'm saying, like, let's just speculate, because no one cares.
Yeah, it's me speculating. Yeah, it's me speculating. My guess is, look, he showed himself to be a great media personality. He's good at it. He's really good at it.
Yeah.
And so that doesn't mean he's going to be good at picking stocks, right? And so it's the classic conundrum, right, where you get somebody really smart, like doctors. We always pick on doctors, but they really tend to do this a lot. Doctors are super, super highly educated, and they have shown their ability by actually becoming advanced surgeons and all. You know, there is no question of their intelligence most of the time, right? But they then tend to carry that over to thinking that they're going to be smart in the market too. It would be like, let's reverse that, right? If I started giving people medical advice and telling them when they needed brain surgery that I said I could do for them, everyone would run away really fast. And yet, like when you move it into the market, everyone all of a sudden thinks, oh, yeah, I can do this. This is easy. And you know what? It is easy if you do two things. Never try to pick a stock. And dollar cost average into your 401k into a cheap index fund, you're going to beat 95% of people over the long term.
Really easy. To come full circle and say the best advice continues to be that. Hopefully, as much as I talk about markets and stocks, that's really the only advice people need. I will sum up this point of the discussion we've had so far as three things. And I will add one thing. We've covered, as we usually do, one thing. Young people are time billionaires. So forget what the headlines say. You are rich. You are rich in time. Put that time to your advantage in long-dated, high-growth, high-margin businesses. And generally, that's through a low-cost index. Second, there is an unfair advantage being an American until it's not.
Yes.
Which is, you've named two things. I will add a third that Michael Lewis blew my mind with, because in its simplicity, is the first is the Bill of Rights. The second, I think you said, is rule of law. And we can make fun and like we don't have a real rule of law. We don't really have a Bill of Rights. But like the system has pretty much, you know, 4 years, 8 years, done its work with presidents and other people. So we can make fun of the system, but it's better than anybody else's so far.
Yep.
I would add the third thing to those two is something Michael Lewis said blew my mind. I mean, obviously, I'm not a huge fan, but I heard him on the Smart List podcast, of all things, and he was explaining to the celebs, Jason Bateman and the other comedian, Will. Anyways,
he Arnett. Was explaining.
Will who?
Well, Will Arnett.
Will Arnett.
I love
yeah,
Will
he's
Arnett.
Great.
He was fantastic. Great.
And he was saying, guys, the system is such that corporations make profits. They get rewarded with higher stock price. When he feels that that system goes away is when he will get out of the market. So it is a lot of truth. Like in the end, we're seeing it again here. If you're not making profits, the market's going to value you at zero when we hit a bear market. If you're spending money and you haven't proved that you can make money, the market has turned and you can't. So in a world where in America, where you have the Bill of Rights, corporations, the game is to have profits, which will lead to higher stock price. And you have rule of law, Bill of Rights, corporate profits, and time billionaire. So fantastic. This is why you're not panicked. And strategically and tactically, you've laid out your thing. Now, let's just talk about the people we can't control, which are the lunatics in charge right now, or negligent, whatever we call them. What is the Fed's job? Do you think they're fully politicized, or do you think they have a semblance of understanding here? Like, what's your hope and fear here?
So again, perspective helps, right? So the Fed was formed in 1913. Directly as a reaction to the panic of 1907, where J.P. Morgan, the man, stepped in and was the lender of last resort. He literally called all of the people who were involved most heavily in the panic to his library, which is still there. You can go see it. It's in the 30s in Manhattan. And he said, he dictated to them, you are bankrupt. You are selling your assets to him. You are buying his. And his actions on that day or week or however long it took essentially stabilized the market, because what the genius was, he knew that panics change into, you know, oh, okay.
Embedded.
I guess we shouldn't panic, right? So he understood that panics have really short fuses if there is a lender of last resort, meaning him then, but the U.S. government decided this is crazy. Like we think we're going to become like this big power and we don't even have a bank that can be the lender of last resort. And thus the Federal Reserve was created in 1913, largely to serve that function. Now they gave the Fed a dual mandate. Everyone knows what that is. I won't bother going through it. But so the Fed uses a model that essentially was based on, I think, Shiller and some other folks up at Yale. It's called the Fed model, obviously. And essentially, we've tested the Fed model, and it really doesn't work in terms of it certainly has no forecasting ability. So at least they claim they use the Fed model. Now we're going to talk about your second question, which is, are they fully politicized? I kind of think that, like, again, here we are thinking that it's so different now and, oh my God, can't you believe how horrible the Fed has become politicized? I got news for you, right? So when they put Volcker in, he was taking his marching orders from the politicians. And they basically said to him, you have to kill inflation. And Volcker, if you read about him, he was a really interesting guy. If you read about him, he's like, you do know, like this is now Reagan, right? You do know, Mr. President, that if I do this and jack up rates to, at some point, I think they were at 16%, the Fed funds rate. You do know that that's going to cause a recession that many might call a depression. And Reagan was like, do it. Inflation is worse. And so they did it, right? So my point is, listen, the Fed is a political beast. It's always been a political beast. When you look and you look at the early Fed, they screwed so many things up because they didn't know how to do anything. If you look at like the Great Depression, right, you still had that old mentality that, you know, people have to be taught a lesson and, you know, we have to wash all this dumb money out. And by the way, markets do that on their own.
They
Hello.
sure fucking
But
do.
exactly, right? So what did the Fed do? Instead of flooding the system with cash, which by the way, was the right thing for the Fed to do during 2020. Let me go on record there. That was the right thing to do because it was, oh, okay, we're all not going to die and eat rats and fucking be in Mad Max world. Okay. So the other thing we got to keep in mind is everything is psychology at the end of the day. And so back in 2020, they did the right thing. But let me go back to what did they do the wrong thing in 1929? They contracted the money supply by 80%.
But what were they
If you
thinking?
want,
What was the
they
date?
were
What were they
thinking,
thinking?
here's what they were thinking. They were thinking that the speculation on Wall Street had gotten out of control. You had all of these crazy motherfuckers making a ton of money, and they were speculating, and it was bad and awful, and they must be punished. And this easy money is, you got to remember the morals of America. For example, I wouldn't say fuck on this podcast. It was 1927 because it was taboo.
Got it.
And so also at the same time, though, they were almost puritanical in their, you must be punished for your malfeasance. And their idea was how to punish the market. And they wrapped it in much prettier words,
Got it.
right? But basically, the way to do that, if you asked me, you said, if you called me and said, Jim, hey, it's Howard, guess what? These crazy fuckers in Washington just made me the head of the Fed. What should I do to cause a depression? My answer would be, Howard, you already know that. Contract the money supply by 80%. You will cause a depression. Boom, that's it. You get a depression.
And you're basically saying
And
socially now that just wouldn't fly.
no, it absolutely wouldn't fly. And what happened is, and I think, by the way, that this is not great for free markets, right? So let me preface my remark by saying I do not think this is a good thing, okay? It's something that we'll work our way out of because of the way we talked about our system earlier, right? The system is designed to take almost anything on and work its way out of it, okay? So, but what we did during the great financial crisis is now haunting us because
Unintended
we,
consequences.
unintended consequences, we socialized losses. And we put the two heretics that we were willing to burn at the stake, Bear Stearns and Lehman Brothers. There's a history there too. Why do you think it was Bear Stearns and Lehman Brothers? Do you think that Lehman was much more leveraged than, oh, Goldman or Morgan Stanley or Merrill Lynch? No. The reason they picked Lehman to make the example of and Bear, guess which two big investment banks did not go in on the big bailout of long-term
Long-term
capital
capital management. It
management?
was payback.
Yep. It was payback. It was
Boys
absolutely
Club.
payback. The boys club, but there actually is not a bad side to one reason for this payback, and that is people laugh at me when I say this, but it's true, and this is an indication of the bad side of it, but on Wall Street, everything is still based on trust, meaning that if you're my counterparty, Howard, and I'm going to just keep doing business, you could have reverses in your business, you could have all sorts of things that happen. But if you continue to honor your word to me, I'm going to still be willing to be your counterparty. The minute you lie to me, or what we call DK, don't know, when you make a bad trade and try to say that you didn't do it, guess what happens? Wall Street closes ranks and you're dead. You're dead. You're out of the street. You cannot be a counterparty anymore. And regular people don't understand that that discipline, right up until when we socialized losses in 07, 08, the socialization of losses was a major mistake. Because if you want to look to the birth of the populist movement in this country that people like Trump took advantage of, if you want to look at the people with pitchforks, that's when it started. It started because regular Americans saw, wait a minute, Goldman Sachs can take all of this, and not to pick on Goldman, let's pick on all the investment banks, right? So, like they, by the way, they were all technically bankrupt,
Sure.
Most people don't know that, but they all were. All. Mm-hmm. And they made them non-bankrupt by essentially an accounting entry. That's why there was no inflation, by the way, back then, when they so-called flooded the market with cash. They really didn't flood the market with cash. All they did was accounting moves. So they moved money to the accounts of Merrill Lynch, the accounts of Goldman, et cetera. And that money never got spent, right? It just stayed on their books. This money got spent, right? The stimmies, right? And so, but back to this 07, socializing losses is horrible because people who are really rich, who got rich by taking risks, should pay the price when the risks go against them.
Absolutely. I'll never get over that because, you know, I'm a foreigner, so I consider myself, I don't know why people are, I love America. So that really was, I've never recovered from that mentally. Of course I recovered, but like, I just can't believe what they got away with. So is the stimmy is bad for unintended circumstances as socializing losses? So the reason we have socialized losses, we have the stimmy. Is the stimmy going to cause as much long-term turmoil or damage to the system as the socialized losses?
No.
Okay,
no.
Good.
Not even close. Not even close. Because the stimmy did what should have been done. And like, if you remember, I think we were actually talking about it at the time. And like, what I was saying to anyone who would listen to me is, why in God's name isn't the government saying, hey, we're forcing you to close down as a business, right? America is mostly small business owners, really. And like, you killed them all. And so they tried to mitigate that with the PPP, the Paycheck Protection Plan.
Right.
And like, then, of course, they vilified anyone who took it. Mm-hmm. And even if they paid it back, right, even though 80% of them didn't get paid back, we didn't take one.
Got it.
Yeah. And we didn't take one because of the optics. I was like, my director of finance was saying, we got to take this. And I'm like, under no circumstances are we taking that money from the government. She's like, why? And I'm like, first off, we don't need it yet. And she's like, but it's free money. And I went, no, it is not free money. It is coming from the government and nothing from the government is free.
Yeah.
I said, what's going to happen is this thing is going to calm down and then somebody with a grudge or an axe to grind is going to request who took them through the Freedom of Information Act. And then you're going to see the mayhem like we saw on Twitter, right? Some people we know very well got chased off the app because they took a PPP loan and repaid it like 3 months later. And yet the pitchforks came out for them because they were well known. So anytime the government is like giving you something, if you're in the wealthy class, right?
Good lesson there.
A great lesson. Now, yeah. the actual stimmy part, that I think was actually quite brilliant because what it did was it assured all Americans, like I didn't get a stimmy, you didn't get a stimmy, we didn't need a stimmy, right? Mm-hmm. And so I was totally in favor of that. Like, rich people should not be getting money given to them from the government.
Yeah.
And so, but it hit the people who really needed it. And listen, when
it
you back
work.
Somebody, it did. It did work.
It did
it
work.
Did
we didn't
work
have pitchforks
because
in the street.
We didn't have pitchforks. We didn't have people like losing their minds, trying to think, you know, locked into their home. Let's just say wherever it is, if it's here in New York or Metro New York, or it's in the middle of the country, it doesn't matter. If you are under government order in your home, unable to operate your business and no source of income, you're going to get violent really quickly, especially if you have kids, especially if you have a family that you have to take care of and feed and do all that stuff. So the stimmy was like, hey, you don't have to worry. You got this money. You'll be okay. And so I personally think it was a genius move. Now, did it cause more inflation? Yeah, of course it did. We're seeing it right now. Because unlike what I said about when they saved the big banks, right? And it was just an accounting thing, right? The stimmy got actually in circulation.
Yeah, 100% got circulated. In Japan, people didn't cash those checks. In the U.S., they levered them up.
Everybody levered those checks up. And then what happened? Americans being Americans, they were like, oh, you know, like,
I'm rich.
I have nice I'm rich, man. I'm rich, bitch.
Let's
speculate. Yeah. And so you get all these crazy assets getting priced to magic ratios. Mm-hmm. And like that shit can't last.
Yeah.
And
well,
it doesn't last. No, it never does. There's an old Wall Street maxim that bear markets are when stocks return to their rightful owners. And like, that's true, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm. So we've definitely covered a lot of ground. I want to cover two more things that you and I talk about all the time, but not directly. It's a new era today. I think unless it's fake news, Elon Musk is going through with the Twitter deal. You and I have were early FinTwit. Some would say I was right there day one. Some would say I'm a fascist.
You ain't no fascist, Howard.
Well, you haven't come to stock twits. So anyways, this is a new era. No, I don't think two people get more out of Twitter than you or I for different reasons, right? In our, we just get such a silly joy out of this.
Yeah.
What do you see the future of Twitter under a new rule? Does it matter? Are you indifferent? Is it exciting?
I'm not indifferent. I honestly think, you know, Musk fascinates me because, like, I don't have a dog in the hunt. I can't own because of the valuation marker on his various stocks. But he fascinates me because, like, there is a method to his madness that underlies everything that if you look really, really closely, it looks like he's being crazy and he's kind of crazy like a fox crazy. In other words, he ain't crazy.
Right.
And so the whole Twitter thing, I agree with him, honestly. I think that Twitter would be better as a private corporation and open sourced.
Of course.
And like if that's what he does, if that's all he does, he is going to ensure that Twitter truly does emerge as the global information intelligence network.
Correct. A priceless asset, private, as a public asset, deteriorating value.
Totally agree. Yeah. Totally agree.
That is footnote on this deal. Keep it private, priceless, take it public, loses value.
Yep. And so if he really honors what he said he was going to do and he open sources it and it's private – and they clean up the, you know, call monitors who are all political and a variety of politics, but mostly of, you know, the super woke variety. And they stop their selective muzzling of people. That's going to be a boon, right? Because information wants to be free. And information, you need differences of opinions for collective assessments to work, right? The wisdom of crowds works when you have people who have very different takes on something, right? Mm-hmm. And that's why the wisdom of crowds works. You've got to have people who've got some skin in the game so that they're at a risk, right? And they have very different opinions. So listen, man, markets are complex adaptive systems with feedback loops. And, you know, you could argue that the feedback loops have sped up. They have, right? And they're much faster than they were when people were riding horses everywhere saying the British are coming. And so what happened? Well, most of those like arbitrage trades went away. There were great arbitrage trades back in the day, man. Like Rothschild made the greatest arbitrage trades of all time because he had spies at the Battle of Trafalgar and he knew the British and he knew the Brits won. But then he added psychology. He went into the market and sold British gilts, which are their bonds, right? So what does everyone else do? They all think, oh my God, Rothschild knows what happened. He sold, the British lost, sell. And he created this huge divot. No one knew that his agents were buying all of those guilts because he already knew that the Brits won. Why? Carrier pigeon, right? And so, like, those kind of traits are gone. You can't – I mean, Ben Graham's cigar butts, they're gone. We've armed them out of existence.
Is it the best trade of all time that he turns it into a hedge fund for himself because it's private? I mean, that's evil genius there. Is he – could
– yeah.
I mean, if I owned it and I, you know, Stocktwits, I don't know how to use data, so I'm an idiot. But I feel I have an edge knowing how to read Stocktwits. I don't use it in the way that I should.
You do have an edge. I've told you that a lot of times. You've got a huge edge because there's an asymmetry of the information knowledge there. You know what everybody on Stocktwits thinks, right? Mm-hmm. A single node on that work. You're a super node on that network, right?
So why doesn't the media call me? So riddle me this, because it's fascinating me. How many months have we talked about bots? I haven't gotten one call from the media running a derivative of Twitter about what I think about the bot situation. Why is nobody working? Why with all the smart people out there, and I'm a super node, why has no one called me and go, Howard, what do you think about the bot problem? Was there a bot problem on Stocktwits? Isn't that fascinating to you that I know the answers?
Yeah.
I don't know them at scale, but I have the exact same problems at subscale.
Yeah, well, because they're not clever enough, honestly, Howard.
It's just sad. I mean,
it is sad. Like, you know what I would fund if it ever came
into
existence?
No, but Elon Musk didn't call me. Why hasn't the board called
me?
Right. Well, it just fascinates me.
I'm sitting there in plain sight on Twitter. That is actually a good question. I would have, if I was Musk, I would have called you for sure.
Or have someone. Hey, because, Howard, can I talk to Rishi? Can I spend 10 minutes with one of my
How
do you deal with spam? Why is there not a spam problem on Stocktwits? And if there is, how do you handle it? And
exactly.
I know you're subscale, but like, give me some feedback.
Yeah.
It's fascinating to me.
So it is fascinating. And shame on Elon Musk because he is smart enough. Whatever you say about the guy, he's a brilliant guy playing a meta game.
I think the meta game is money. Obviously, information. I will add that information and P is meant to be free based on my Dublin photos. P just needs to go. Information and P in the right wind direction needs to be free. Otherwise, there's a cost of P. Cost of P is depending on which way you're facing.
Man, I tell you, the cost of P is highly variable.
Variable based on your knowledge of the wind. But
really volatile too, because if you're peeing on someone, you're going to get into some problems probably.
I insulted many of the gods. But I posted that picture not because I took the picture. I didn't know the picture was being taken, but I found it funny after seeing it.
Oh, I thought it was hysterical.
Let's end with something that we're both lucky men. I'm lucky because I was born in Toronto, no war, wealthy. To crazy parents like everybody, but I was born on third base, and I've managed to parlay that into a life in the United States, and so it's a gift, really. I look at the world through a lens that's optimistic, and so the only joy I get is that, luckily, from my kids. Like, I put all my energy into seeing them be successful. You seem to, and then I model my mentorship around people that have that same, and it's the same thing about my cycling thing. I ended up on a trip. Call it what you want. Successful guy's not. 138 years of marriage. I modeled a world in which I hang around people like myself. And so as a parent, I look up to how I see you, not as an investor or as a mentor or as a businessman, but as how you interact, because I've been around the fam and the missus. And how do you feel you got that lens, and how much are you enjoying that?
So I think, as you know, you said you were born on third base. I was born sliding into home, And like, I come from a very rich family. I was delighted that my grandfather, who at one point was the richest Irish Catholic in America, gave away 95% of his own fortune during his own lifetime, because he thought that was the right thing to do. And so, nevertheless, I was still born sliding into home. And family just has always been super important to me. You know, I was very, very lucky. I guess we call it the lucky ovum or the lucky sperm club to like get born into this family, into this country in 1960, like, you know, 9 years before President Kennedy decided on a whim, because he was pissed that the Russians had Sputnik, that he decided, okay, they've got Sputnik, we're going to the fucking moon. And like, the engineers at the time were like, Mr. President, you know, we really have no way to do that. And he's like, find a way. And so I not only was I born into this great family that was very bright and wealthy, but also I was born into the greatest country in the world, I think. And certainly at that time. And like, how do you go wrong? And then, you know, I started my career in equities in 1982. Almost all of my adult life was declining interest rates. Like, talk about a beautiful scenario. And so what I'll say is this, like, there were other people who were born like you and like me, but they didn't play their hand well. So it's not just where we got born that determines how we do in life. You got to play the hand. And some people get a shitty hand and play it really, really well, and they do really, really well. Some people get a great hand, like me and you, and play it horribly, and they don't do well at all. Back to family. Like, listen, man, my family is everything to me. I'm super lucky. I've been married 40 years. We had our 40th anniversary in August. We got married when we were children. We were 22. We had Patrick when we were 24. So I have an 8-year-old grandson who was just over here tonight for dinner. That's why we had to move the podcast time. Like, and I get to see my grandchildren that live here in Greenwich all the time. And I love them. And we like really know each other. And my middle daughter or youngest daughter just moved back to Brooklyn. And she's having a baby soon, a little boy. And so I'm going to know him. And my daughter, Kate, who lives in California, comes often, and my granddaughter with her is Langdon. I am like, if we're talking about what matters in my life, that's what we're talking about, right? We're talking about these experiences that I am able to have with my family. And like, I love it. I mean, you know, my grandfather said something, and oddly, I didn't know this until way later in my life, but it turns out he was talking about me. And a reporter asked him, like in 1961, like, what would you do if like an angel of God came down and said that your youngest grandchild, that would have been me at the time, was going to die if you didn't give up your money? And my grandfather said, I would give it up. I wouldn't even take a second. I would, of course, give it up. And I can say the same thing. If somebody was holding a gun to my head and said, you know, you got to take everything you've got, like all of your money, all of your possessions, everything, and it's going to save Langdon's life or the as yet unborn little boy that my daughter's having, I wouldn't even think about it. I would just like immediately take that trade. Because, I mean, honestly, that's what this is all about. It's the journey, and the journey is your family. And I've just got very lucky like you. You've got a beautiful family. And, you know, I haven't met your son yet, but your daughter's a gas. I love her. And Ellen's fantastic.
Yeah, we're lucky. I think if you get the hand, you know, you can't feel guilty playing it. You can't.
Play
you
it.
Can't feel guilty. There's a lot of people that are like feeling guilty about playing a good hand, and it's a shame. So this has been a treat. You're the man. I want to talk about the future, so we didn't get to that, but we'll do it. We'll do a future panic where we'll talk about AI and
sure.
Some of the trends, because that was actually what I wanted to get to, but. That's enough of your time. I feel like we covered a lot of ground. I'm glad you're well, and we'll talk before the end of the year.
Looking forward to it, Howard, as always.
All right, Jimmy. Talk to you.
All right. Thanks, man.
Cheers.
Cheers.
K-Nut!
Howie!
That's what you get when you talk to legends. get some wisdom.
He is a true legend. There is no doubt about that.
The thing I like about it is we both just, you know, we can't change our past. So you just got to live in the, you just got to move forward. It is what it is. You got dealt. I don't know. I got lucky. So I'm just going to keep playing it. You were listening to Panic with Friends. That was Jim O'Shaughnessy, who is not panicked. And I think he laid out a good case of being focusing on your time. And young people, the lesson is you are a time billionaire. Embrace that. Knut and I, have been doing this a couple years. We do these every Thursday. You can go to Spotify, Apple, iTunes, subscribe. So you don't have to think about it. Get a podcast from Knut and I. We talk about the future. We talk about the markets. We talk about trends, finding them and riding them. Thanks, everybody, for tuning in. See everybody next week.
Howard Lindzen is the founder and general partner at Social Leverage. All opinions expressed by Howard and podcast guests are solely their own opinions and do not reflect the opinion of Social Leverage or StockTwits. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon for decisions. Guests may maintain positions and securities discussed in this podcast.